You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio. Mino Studio is a pre- and post-production facility for all of your audio needs. Mino Studio's founder is an accredited audio engineer with top 40 and indie album credits. With over 30 years of music industry experience, Mino Studio can take your podcast from idea to reality. Contact Mino Studio at MinoStudio777@gmail.com for more information. That's MinoStudio777@gmail.com.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manassero.
Well, welcome, old dogs. We are here today with a different kind of program. So many of you have asked me about funding and sources of funding and how to get the funds you need in order to purchase the properties that you're looking at. We have sort of an interesting approach today. We're going to be talking about something called family offices. And in that, I'm not going to define it for you right now. I'm going to have our guest do that. But this gentleman is sort of Mr. Family Office, I would say. He is very much involved in this industry, and I'll give you a little bit of his background. Our guest is Richard C. Wilson. He helps 100 million plus net worth families create and manage their single family offices and currently manages 14 clients, including mandates with three billionaire families, and as the CEO of a 500 million plus single family office and head of direct investments for another with 200 million plus in assets. Richard is also the founder of the Family Office Club, the largest membership-based family office association, along with Equity Holdings and the Training Single Family Office Management Investment Conference, Search Data Research, Physical Bullion, Private Equity, Food and Energy Industries, which do over $10 million a year in combined revenue. Through operating the Family Office Club Association, Richard has created the first platform business focused on the family office industry. He has spoken at over 150 conferences in 17 countries and has the number one best-selling book in the family office industry. Richard has undergrad degree from Oregon State University, MBA from the University of Portland, and has studied master's level psychology through Harvard's ALM program. Richard currently resides 10 minutes from downtown Miami on the island of Key Biscayne, Florida, with his wife and two daughters. Whew, that's a mouthful. You're a busy man, Richard.
I got to shorten that up. That was a little bit ridiculous. But we do a lot of stuff, but only in the family office industry, essentially. At least the things that we spend time on. We might invest in something that's an operating business, like a food business or consumer products business, but all of it is related to family offices. And lots of times people say, why don't you just do these conferences that you hold, because we have these big 500-person type events every quarter. And, what I always explain is that the whole reason we got into the conference business is there's all these people offering a family office conference, and they had never worked in the industry a day in their life. They put people on stage that were just selling stuff to family offices. They were not family offices either. And the room was often filled with people who are not family offices. So it was all very backwards. And we just see like massive alignment with being in charge of sourcing great deal flow for our $100 million plus net worth clients. And then running the conference called Family Office Deal Flow, where you have 400 people in the room and people are going to bring their deals to that room. Like, they're very much not conflicting. Like, it makes the other things we do more powerful. So that's why it's a longer bio, because, and that's why we use the word platform company, because we really see it as a platform and not like a whole bunch of one-off entities.
Well, for those that have never even heard the term family office, could you just give us a, again, taking it from the folks who've never heard this term before, explain what a family office is?
Sure. Essentially, it's a more holistic, full balance sheet solution for managing your wealth if you're worth $100 million or $400 million or $2 billion. And, you know, a good example of this is if you sell your business for $300 million, you might not want to walk down to your local Bank of America, Merrill Lynch Connect, and, you know, trust the guy behind the desk to, you know, with your $300 million. Like, he's probably never met anybody with that much money. And most of his clients have $300,000 or $3 million. And so when you have $300 million, a 1% mistake on selling an asset too early or too late, or not structuring something right, or not gifting something early enough, could cost you $1 million. And that $1 million could have been spent on a full-time team, like surrounding you with the best quality service providers and people just looking out for your best interests. So the whole idea of a family office is that the more money you have, the more problems and potential risks to your capital you have. And as a percentage of your total wealth, just spending 0.5% or 1% could mean that you have superior access to, you know, great agnostic kind of resources that aren't trying to sell you things, but are really serving you. So I think that that's like an important part of it.
So the maybe the key word here is personal finances of families, wealthy families, right? You're not involved in their corporations. Like a Mark Cuban, you know, wouldn't have anything to do with his businesses or sports teams he owns or any of that. But it would be his personal family's finances, right?
Right. But one of his holdings, you know, could be, you know, basketball team. One of his holdings could be the LLCs that he has created around Shark Tank. So it could definitely include, you know, one of my clients has 100 different LLCs that he's participated in or owns currently in his portfolio. So it is all their business operating entities as part of that puzzle that they're managing.
So the person that makes the conscious decision to set up a family office, what's really involved in that process? Does he go out and interview people and try to select someone that has a good understanding of investments? And how do you go about setting up a family office?
It's great. Our book called The Single Family Office on Amazon is the best-selling one that you referred to earlier. And the most recent book that we just came out with is literally called How to Start a Family Office. And right before this, I was speaking with Julia, who we're interviewing to add to our single family office team at a single family office that I helped launch in August last year for somebody that just sold their business for $600 million. So I think the question you asked is very timely in terms of all the activity I'm focused on personally in our business. And essentially, what we always start with is asking 50 to 70 questions about where that family wants to go and why, their history of wealth creation, where they've been burned in the past and either lost money or been taken advantage of or sued or lost assets, et cetera, and just what their family culture and values are. Because what I often find is that templates try to be applied or consultants come in. And if you don't have everything documented on where you're going and why and the reasoning and values behind that, then nothing else really matters. And part of that is going to be wasted. And so if you start with that, then it can be a decision-making tool for everybody on the team on who you hire, why you're hiring them, where to have your offices, what assets you should be investing in, et cetera. So I think that's the very most important part about starting a family office, is to figure out why you're doing it, your motivation, and then all the history and value and mission parts that drive everything else that will come for the next 10 years in running that single family office.
And does your organization actively recruit the I don't know, what would you call the position of the person that runs a family office? CEO, manager?
Yeah, usually CEO is the title for the person running the single family office. The patriarch or the head of the family might have discretion over a lot of big decisions, like the $500 million family that I'm helping run their family office for. You know, the individual is 46 years old, and he's very much engaged in every single deal. So we spent, you know, 3 months conducting due diligence on a $100 million waterfront hotel, for example, and we ended up killing it at the end of the day just because of the terms of the deal and the cap rate just being a little bit too low. And, you know, so I think that it's different than being CEO of a company where you might have full discretionary reins over the assets of the company typically.
So the patriarch, as you would refer to him, would more than likely be very active in the decision-making process, or is it sometimes, well, here's the funds, I trust your ability, you can do it? How does that normally work out?
Most of the time, the family is very actively involved. I'd say 80 to 90% of the time. The only time it's not is when maybe it's a formalized multi-generational family where there's a more corporate board, an independent governance board, et cetera. But there'll typically always still be a board or somebody overseeing the CEO of the single family office. And, you know, board members and governance is really important. So otherwise, people will take advantage of a discretionary mandate or take advantage of access to resources many times. So I think families almost always like to be involved. And one of the main reasons for that is that most of them created their wealth through, and it's first generation wealth most of the time, and 90% of our clients are first generation wealth. And they created it through having control, creating a business, taking it public, creating a business and selling it, creating a business, and the cash flow from it is enormous. So, you know, it's made them wealthy by adding value through a control position. Typically, you know, some people are is own a few percentage points in like a Facebook or some shares in a Facebook type group, but those aren't the typical family offices. Most of these people did not inherit or get lucky and then become worth $100 million. And so to start a family office and then say, okay, well, you know, we got to $300 million in wealth by having control and being really smart, but let's go find someone else who is not worth $100 million and entrust him with all our money and he'll make good decisions for us. Like, that's not how a lot of these family offices think, that there's not going to be the full alignment, and most people don't have the experience of creating that much wealth in their lifetime.
Is there some sort of checks and balances established in a family office that people feel comfortable with this person running their finances or handling their finances for them?
For sure there are, and there's all different types of levels. They might have discretion for everything except for investments. They might be able to select the service providers and hire and fire and staff and manage the P&L of the quote-unquote business, but maybe for an investment over $1 million or over $5 million, it takes multiple levels of approval. And then sometimes the CEO is simply making sure all the trains are leaving the station and playing quarterback and getting the service providers talking to each other, and the investment stuff might be really 50-50 with the family because they like to be engaged on that. So there's a full spectrum of you know, how much rope is given to the CEO of a family office.
Now, is the CEO, the family office CEO, usually solo? Does he have a staff? What's sort of the typical scenario?
So most single family offices, which are, you know, family offices just for one family, typically have, you know, 4 to 7 professionals on the small end. And many times they can have 50 or 100 plus if they're a $1 billion plus family. But there's many family offices that are very small. I know one that's $800 million and they have one full-time person. And then they have a lot of consultants and service providers and they outsource as much as possible. They're trying to change that because they can't survive with one person. But at this small end with a $50 million family, a $200 million family, many times those just have 2 to 4 full-time professionals. And you'll hear a term called a virtual family office. And that's essentially when you do just have half of a dedicated person or one full-time person and everything else is virtual and there is no formalized office space or formalized team. And that's an option for some families as well that want to keep things really lean.
Yeah, where does the CEO usually work at, or for the most part?
Well, typically, you know, we did a benchmark study of 180 family offices, and we found that only 55% of the family offices who responded actually have dedicated office space just for the family office. And we also found that only about 50% are having the family office ran by someone who is outside of their family. And so, you know, when you look at the number of family offices out there, there's far more families worth 50 million or 100 million than a billion plus. So out of that survey, obviously, it's going to be skewed towards the smaller sized family offices. But any family with more than, say, 200 to 300 million in assets is much more likely to have dedicated office space to the family office. And at the 500 million and up, I think just about every family I know has their own dedicated office space just for the family office that is geographically connected to the operating entities and where the family actually lives.
Oh, really? So they have offices in, let's say, a home as well?
Oh, not where they live, like their personal home, but like their city. So like they're based in Minneapolis, their family office team will almost always be in Minneapolis. Maybe if they just love hedge fund managers or CTA managers, they might need an office in New York or in Chicago for some of that fund manager due diligence. But that's really more rare. Usually the families are already based in the place where they made their money and they can use their skill set. So they typically like to be close to them and manage that team very closely to make sure that, you know, resources aren't being wasted.
Now, I'm sure investments are divided over a broad field, but maybe you could give us sort of an idea, sort of typical areas of investment for most family offices.
Sure. So most families invest in real estate as part of their portfolio, and of families that do, in our benchmark study, we found that it was typically 25% of their portfolio. Most of these families have, you know, 3 to 7 different residences with cars and maybe some staff helping oversee those residences. And then in the operating business side or fund manager public market side, really depends on how the family made their money. If they made their money on Wall Street, they're much more likely to have a diversified portfolio. If they made their money in hedge funds, they're likely to have some hedge fund operating entities that they can push more money through, and it acts as an investment into the public markets on their behalf. And so if the family made their money, like the family I have a call with tomorrow has a $100 million plus a year agricultural business, and they're based in the Midwest, and they are looking to start a family office. And so in their case, their investments are very much operating business focused in real estate, and they have very little public market or fund manager investment. So the creation of the wealth, the source of it, is a big determinant of where the percentages are and where it's going to get invested. But it's a mainstay that most of these families are investing in real estate. And also importantly is if it's second or third generation, it's more likely to be diversified unless the family has a strong culture and, you know, mission and history around operating businesses or around a single area like hedge funds. It typically will get more diversified over the generations as more people have a say in where the money goes and more people get afraid of losing it when they weren't the ones who created the wealth. So they might be less confident about taking a big risk on only investing in agriculture, which could feel like a risk to someone who didn't make all their money there, but it feels like the least risky thing to someone who knows that space backwards and forwards.
Right. Do you see trends or shifts out of the market, the stocks, bonds, securities, in light of, you know, the fluctuations in the market?
For sure. I think that when we started, we've held 52 conferences in the past 9 years. And when we started, I would say that 10 or 20% of the conversation in 2007, 2008 was about direct investing into operating businesses. And there was talk of real estate investments back then, of course, and families have always been investing directly into real estate. But now at our events, we have a whole event focused just on that topic, and it probably makes up 30 or 40% of what people want to talk about at our events and what they are spending time investing in as a family office. And I think it comes back to the control issue of these families might have some allocation to public markets, but a lot of them after 2007, 2008, 2011, have taken some of that money off the table and said, well, instead of going through a private equity fund manager where it's a blind pool, we don't know what operating businesses they're going to buy, we're going to go a little bit more into the lower middle market or even below and go into, say, a $500,000 in profits or EBITDA per year or a $2 million in EBITDA per year, $4 million EBITDA per year, and we're going to buy that company at 3 to 4 times, and we're going to grow it, and we'll sell it to a private equity fund at 7 or 8 times or 6 times, you know, down the road, and grow value that way instead of trusting our money in a publicly traded company CEO that, you know, we don't have control over. And, you know, the public market sentiments might change our return versus our patience or agility in navigating the business ourselves. So I think that that all plays into it, but definitely the direct investment trend is really big right now. And a lot of family offices, to some extent, have said, well, we have a fund manager platform. We have access to fund managers through our private bank or through this, you know, SMA platform, et cetera, or through a fund to fund. So we're going to make that efficient, but we're going to spend our personal time on doing the direct investment component and focusing on that. So a lot of families do that. Not all of them, but a lot of families have been leaning that way recently.
Does the family office typically handle philanthropy as well?
Yes, I think that they always have the philanthropic part as part of the family's activities. I don't know any $100 million families that don't give away money, but it may or may not be trusted under the CEO, or there may or may not be professional staff. I think if you have a professionalized foundation, then that typically will require like the controller helping oversee it perhaps, and maybe one or two full-time people. But the philanthropy is the last thing to be outsourced. Typically the family likes typically to see the results of giving their money away. It's just when the administration of giving that money away becomes burdensome that they add more professional staff inside the family office.
What amount of time would you say the family office CEO spends with the patriarch, the person that represents the family? How much time per week?
Yeah, I think it depends on how actively involved the family is and how fully allocated they are on investments. But for example, in my case, between text messages, emails, phone calls, in-person meetings, it might be 2 to 4 hours a week sometimes. And other times we'll spend 2 full days going through deals, and it'll just be 2 days out of the week, you know, 8-hour days or 10-hour days going through deals. So just depends on the family, but a wide spectrum. I mean, some CEOs are left to manage things, and the whole summer the family might be gone, and you just check in with them on one major transaction you're working on. So you might talk to the actual family only once during a whole summertime when they're in France or Hamptons or something.
Now, with real estate, zeroing in a little bit more on real estate side of it, to 25%, obviously they must like real estate investment. So why would you say that's one of those areas that they really really vest themselves in?
I think people like to invest in things they can understand, and most people can get their arms around, you know, how an apartment building could make money, and how, because it's next to a hospital or university or oceanfront, that it will probably always be making money as long as it's properly insured and, you know, other factors have been considered. Then I think that they just see it as something they can touch, and it's hard asset. So I think that families appreciate that as well. And I think that there's just a lot of examples of families becoming ultra wealthy through owning real estate assets and using leverage. You know, to navigate getting leverage on a real estate building is easier than getting leverage on an operating business. And so I think that's another component that families like as well. So it's I think there's this could be for sure like a whole, you know, a whole book or hour-long topic on this. I don't want to get too long-winded on it, but I think that, you know, apartment buildings, office buildings, and hotels are the three most common areas that families like to go into. And I just think that for some of them, it functions as a next-generation, can't-mess-it-up type asset. Like, you get an apartment building, you have it in a properly structured trust, and you have very low leverage on it, and it's in a great location and well-insured. You know, it's just going to be maybe a low return money machine, but maybe just a money machine for the business if properly managed and maintained, et cetera. So I think that it's used in different strategic ways inside of different families for next generation support and kind of like almost an endowment function for the family sometimes.
So what's sort of a typical minimum investment for an apartment building, for example, for a family office?
Well, I'm looking at 4 right now that are all very inexpensive. They're all $1 to $3 million and they're in a soon to be developed part of a major city. So our thought is that we're going to hold on to it, and we don't care how bad the cap rate is, because we're really playing it like a land bank and just saying like, well, eventually some developer is going to buy it from us for a huge amount of money. So we're going very low end on that. But other apartment buildings, I would say the typical ones would be, you know, $3 to $10 million, $5 to $15 million for the typical family office. And then obviously lots of the larger families at $1 billion plus don't like to get their hands dirty and even spend time on due diligence unless something is going to be a $20 million size property or a $25 million size property. So that's the number that always comes up with $1 billion families, is they really want to start at a $20 million transaction or larger. Then obviously the smaller the family, the more small of a deal they're likely to go into. But, you know, one of the single family offices I work with, you know, have done 5 deals in the past 10 months, and the last 2 were real estate deals, and they are both $1.25 million and $775,000. So pretty small size transactions on those two.
Do family offices typically want to take the lead primary or JV partner position as opposed to being one of a number of other investors?
I think that as people get to 20, 30, 50 million net worth, the answer starts to change. And over 100 million net worth, they always want to be typically the majority or a joint venture and have pretty fair sponsor, you know, type terms. I think that if somebody is worth 10, 20, 30, 40 million, they're much more likely to not have the team and not be equipped to go and do a deal without a sponsor or to do those deals consistently. So there's more value in using a sponsor to not only source the deal, but help run it, be the asset manager on it. Whereas, you know, if you're worth $200 million and some guy brings you a deal and says, you know, hey, you put up 90%, I put up 10, I'm going to charge you a management fee. And then after a 15% hurdle, you know, I want 33% of profits. The $200 million net worth guy is going to say, get lost. I can hire a full-time guy, pay him $100,000 a year or $300,000 a year. He'll find me a deal just as good as this, and I'll owe him nothing on the waterfall and no management fee. And he'll just build a team around it and not have to pay a percentage of the upside. So I think that there's a segment of the family office space where even the larger family offices could be open to an excellent deal, even if it's a sponsored deal, because it's so great. But the level of interest goes down in paying high sponsorship fees, which, by the way, no matter what the fees are, people always tell us they're industry standard. I've heard that 50% is industry standard on a waterfall split, and I've heard that 20% is industry standard. And I think anything more than 10 or 20% is, you know, pretty aggressive, especially for a family worth over 100 million to give up 25% of profits.
They didn't get that money by going in on deals that don't look that favorable.
Yeah, for sure. So I think that'd be I don't understand why so many people come out with whether it's an investment fund manager and they're trying to charge a full 2 and 20, or they're a sponsor and they haven't done any deals yet, but they want to charge like a 33% or 40% promote. And it's like they should be much more long term greedy and more short term, you know, amenable to, I think, what investors want, and just charge like a no management fee, only performance, or just charge 10% promote, or 15% or 18% promote, or something over a over a hurdle. Because I just see some of these people coming to our conferences, and you know they haven't done a deal yet by the way they talk, and they admit that they haven't done a deal yet, but they're still trying to like rake the investor. And it's like those two things can't go together. So I always encourage people to like just get deals done, build the respect with the family, and then it could turn into something big versus shooting yourself in the foot before you've taken a single step, you know?
Yeah, get that track record, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, if somebody does have a deal, how approachable are family offices, and what's the best way to present a deal or try to get a deal in front of a family office?
Sure. So I think that they are approachable and they respond to good ideas. They don't respond to essay long emails. They don't respond to like badgering and people trying to like be very pushy and trying to like get past the secretary and be by being like rude or short with them. And I think that sometimes people can be too aggressive in trying to get the attention of the family office. But an excellent deal is an excellent deal. And if you can communicate that in a single sentence, that helps. If it's local to the family with real estate, that helps a lot. People in a suburb of Colorado, of Denver. You know, they don't understand what's going on in Palm Beach versus Brickell versus Coral Gables in Florida, in South Florida. They don't understand that, and vice versa. So it's a very local game, and it's a very trust-based game. So getting referrals, obviously that helps, but most people listening to this probably have only met with a few family offices, and they might not be getting a lot of referrals in. So there's really three ways that I see you can get access to family offices consistently. And these have been created in our business naturally. So these haven't been, you know, thought up because, you know, I had some great insight and then I tried it and it actually worked. These came up because people were requesting this over and over again. So one thing is when we started, people are asking, you know, do you have a directory or a database of family offices? We always said, no. And then in 2007, we started creating our first one, and now we've been updating that for 9 years. And, you know, of course, you can get a directory of contact details for them. The thing that people mess up is they want to send an email and they, oh, yeah, we'll email 400 of them and hopefully 2 respond or 10 respond. But the way to use that is, you know, if you're going to Chicago, you see who else you could meet with in Chicago and you get a face-to-face meeting and you build a real relationship. Or you identify 5 cities near you you could fly to in 2 or 3 hours or less and you build real relationships with the people in those cities. Using a database or directory or building your own and then like blasting out some message essay on why you have the best property, you know, on the face of the planet is never going to get anybody responding at all. And everybody gets too many of those emails. And the second resource is just figuring out where they congregate and getting in person with them. It could be at a local charity event, or it could be at a political fundraising dinner. It could be at one of our, you know, family office club conferences we host quarterly. And I think just being face-to-face with the local family offices in those cities you're focused on obviously helps. And then the third way, which is how our entire business is built, is through not finding them, but having them find you. So essentially, how do you position yourself and identify different areas of demand or headaches they have and be a solution to that? If your expertise is in hospitality or parking garages, how do you be the person either in your local community or nationally that's best known in the family office community or the local high net worth, ultra wealthy community, et cetera, for that niche area? And then we just try to identify that and provide as much value in that little box as possible. And the perfect example is like what we talked about earlier. You know, we identified that single family offices were an important area. So we bought singlefamilyoffices.com. We wrote a 300-page book on it and spent 700 hours doing that. And now we give out that book at events I speak at and promote that book quite a bit. But then we found that a more valuable box for us to be in would be actually helping people start their family office. So that's why we wrote that follow-on book, because we want to meet that demand, that type of migraine in someone's head. So being the number one expert or the most resourceful, helpful person in a certain area, like office buildings for sale in Manhattan, et cetera, is a position that will bring people to you over and over again that you can propel through white papers, books, speaking at events, positioning your corporate brand and image, et cetera. So that's how our entire business is built. That's the most authentic advice I think I can give on how to attract these families.
That's great advice. Thank you. Well, we're getting near the end of our interview here, so we have a little session we call Wrap Up Session. In that, I'll ask you a series of questions, which will share your knowledge and information with people that would like to know more here. If you're ready, I'll go ahead and shoot these questions at you.
Sure.
What would be your favorite real estate book?
Favorite real estate book? I would say that... favorite real estate book. Yeah, to be honest, I don't read a lot of real estate books. I read a lot of real estate pitch books, one pagers. So, I think it's like a bad thing to say on a real estate podcast, but it's just honest. I mean, I read a ton of books. I mean, 0 to 1, just to get a book out there that's amazing that everybody should listen to get some value from my answer or non-answer, it would be 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. I think there's so many genius ideas in that book. And there's like 2 or 3 really good ideas in that book. And typically I'm happy if I get 1 great idea out of a book. So I would encourage everyone to go out and get that book, because you can apply that to any business, including real estate.
That's great. Any other business book you would recommend?
I would say also Mastering the Rockefeller Habits by Vern Harnish, who's one of the founders of EO, you know, which I'm a member of. He has a concept in there called choke points, and he talks about how Rockefeller used that in his business. And we really talk about choke points a lot with inside our company, and at our capital raising workshops, we talk about that. And I just think that it's a way for anybody to get leverage in an industry is by identifying a choke point and then owning that choke point. It just builds momentum in your business to obtain other choke points in your space.
What about most valuable website that you use on a regular basis?
In a real estate space, I'd have to say LoopNet. I mean, it's a boring answer that everyone's already familiar with. But in a real estate space, I would say that has to be it.
What about your favorite app?
Favorite app? Let's see here. Probably my Audible app, just because it just helps me get an extra book or two to listen to per week.
Great. Final question here. What would be your advice to somebody who is in the real estate investing space? They've got apartments and so forth, and you know, they're trying to think of what's the first thing I should do to, you know, get an entry into the family office area.
I think it would be to identify what's unique in your DNA. Is it your geographical focus combined with the focus on boutique hotels, and or maybe it's something completely different, obviously, but identifying that unique DNA, the unique value, unique insight you could provide, and then thinking through how do you be the person people think about most often and think about first to the audience you're trying to reach, family offices, local ultra wealthy, plastic surgeons in your area, professional athletes, et cetera. So I think that would be the very first step I would go through, is defining that unique position and then building on that and making it crystal clear through all of your branding and, you know, taglines for your company, et cetera.
Excellent. Well, how can people get a hold of you? Is there a way you recommend?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if they want to contact me directly, my email is richard@wilsonholdingcompany.com. Otherwise, the Family Office Club website is familyoffices.com. And then, you know, we spent about 700 hours writing our book called The Single Family Office, and I think it's 99 cents on Kindle, or $7 paperback. Like, we're out just to spread that as far and wide as possible, and we guarantee if someone buys it and they don't love it, we'll give you your 99 cents or $7 back. We've never had anybody ask for that. We've said this on every podcast interview we do, just because we spent so much time, you know, writing that book and putting the 40 video modules in it and the 30 interviews in it, et cetera. So I would hope people would, you know, take a look at that, because it's essentially free. It's as close as free as we can get, basically.
That's a great book. I second that. Very, very interesting information, and invaluable if you're looking at this space.
Thanks for saying that.
Wow. Well, Richard, I tried to warn you in advance here through our letter that we always close the broadcast here by asking our guests to give us, because we're called the Old Dogs Network here, so we ask people to give us their best old hound dog howl. Now, I don't know if there's any howling hound dogs down in Florida, South Florida there, but, you know, give us your best shot.
Ow!
All right.
I don't know. I'm getting older. I've got a third daughter on the way this fall, so I'll be feeling like an older dog by the day here pretty soon.
Great. I love it. Well, Richard, thank you so much for joining us here, and just great information. This is one of those broadcasts you want to listen to over and over. Boy, again, this is, I think you are the source for family offices. I'd never heard of family offices until I heard of you, and it just opened up this whole area that I wasn't even aware of. But what a great, great resource, and a great, great organization you've got going there.
Great. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Well, you bet. And thank you. Hopefully we'll stay in contact here.
Yeah, for sure. We should. Take care.
All right. Take care.